Guide me, O thou great Jehovah, pilgrim through this barren land. I am weak, but thou art mighty. Hold me with thy powerful hand. Bread of heaven, bread of heaven, feed me till I want no more. Feed me till I want no more.
Could somebody bring me a glass of water? My throat feels sort of dry. We greet you in Jesus' name. I had that song sung for a purpose. Turn to Genesis chapter 12. We're looking at Abraham today. And he certainly was a pilgrim. He certainly had to learn by experience what he knew by faith, that he was weak, but God was strong and could lead him. The title of the message this morning is God's Abram, God's Faith Pioneer. Abram, God's Faith Pioneer. Now, a pioneer is someone who braves a new path. And in a sense, Abraham was not doing that. We have Noah, we have Seth, we have some people that did that before him. But in a sense, Abraham is braving a new frontier in his life. God had worked with mankind as a whole up until this point in the book of Genesis. And twice he had to intervene because mankind as a whole headed down a disastrous path. It was going to take the whole world in that direction. And of course, first he sent a flood. And then after the flood, that same iniquity begins to work, especially in the life of Nimrod and his efforts to create a kingdom built on force, violence, tyranny, and get a group of people together and under tyrannical rule form something that would be powerful and great. And so God saw that begin to happen. And of course, in the last lesson, he confused the languages and scattered the people and did what I think he intended for man to be all along, and that is for them to be in little units here and there and not to be in one big monolithic structure. he forced that to happen. But the problem was that the evil had already so affected the people by the time that happened that they carried Babylon with them wherever they went, and it got scattered over the whole world. And so now we have the whole world headed down that road again. And so God takes a different approach now. He decides that he's going to, well, he doesn't decide. This is already in his mind from the creation, before the creation. But he's going to call out one family. And in that family, he's going to create his own nation. And he's going to demonstrate to the whole world who he is. And he's going to do that in such an attractive way that all nations will finally flow into that. And of course, he's going to send a redeemer to take care of the problem that man has not been able to overcome. And it's going to come through that family. And so he's launching a new program. But before he did that, he had to find somebody that was capable of having a mind and a heart that was big enough to be the father and founder of a family that would be a beachhead to the faith that he wanted the whole world to see. And he had to choose somebody that could wade through all of this confusion and all of this stuff that was going on in the world, and would have enough tenacity, would have a large enough view, and would have a strong enough heart that he would be able to bring God's program to get it on his way. All right? And he found that person in the person of Abraham. And I think it's interesting that Abraham was a unique person, not just as a person, but he was a unique person to God. He's the only person in the Bible that we have called the friend of God. God says in Isaiah, he says, Abraham, my friend. Well, In what way was Abraham a friend to God? I'm sure these other men that we mentioned, these other Noah and so on, they were friends to God too. But in a very, very special way, Abraham was a friend to God. It wasn't just that God blessed him. When God was with Abraham, Abraham got blessed. But when God was with Abraham, God got blessed. And that just intrigues me. That excites me. That's what I want to be. Well, what is a friend? Well, a friend is someone you can share your secrets with. And God wanted someone that He could tell the wonderful things that He had in mind. He wanted someone He could do that with. A friend is someone who believes in your goodness. They trust you. He wanted someone that would believe in His goodness. Furthermore, a friend is someone who can understand the feelings of your heart and draw them out, especially when situations come up that you tend to pull your feelings back into yourself. This person can come along and sort of draw out those true feelings again. And you say, well, did God need that? Well, I guess what I'm thinking about is God was going to destroy Sodom. But God is a God of mercy. And God is a God of forgiveness. And God is a God of love. And Abraham goes and he intercedes with God and he draws out of God. I don't want to say in spite of God, but you know what I mean. God had tended to sort of draw back in himself towards Sodom, and he was going to just pour out fire on them. And Abraham did what a friend does. He came along a little bit like Abigail did to David, or trying to think, there are other people in the scriptures. Moses, of course, did this with God too. He brought out of God what was really in his heart toward the people of Sodom. And so, that's, you know, Abraham was a friend in that way. A friend is someone who gives the full scope to someone's love and goodness. Makes that person look good. Just when the person's with him, it just magnifies all that's good and grand and glorious and noble in the person's character. And I just, you know, I was just thinking of some things that Abraham meant to God. God could share his secrets with him. He believed in God's goodness. He was able to give full scope to God's goodness and his love and demonstrate that to the world around him. He was able to draw out from God the best that was in God. He was a true friend. All right? Well, Acts says that the glory of God of glory appeared first unto our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he dwelt in Haran and said unto him, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and come unto the land which I will show thee. And so here we have this call renewed. We find this that this call didn't originate here. This call originated, according to Stephen, in Acts chapter 7. It originated when he was still back there in Mesopotamia. It says, the God of glory appeared unto him. So we have the first, I'm going to give you a big word. Theophany. Simply means a visual manifestation of God. Now, it probably took that for Abraham to actually see the glory of God. I don't know if it was Christ in person that came or if it was an angel. I don't think it was. I think it was God. It says the Lord of glory appeared unto him. So the first thing that happened to Abraham when he was first called is God literally visibly appeared to him. That must have been awesome. And Abraham is the first person in the scriptures that ever happened to. Now, God did speak to Noah. Maybe it happened. We don't have any record that God appeared to Noah. We don't have any record after Adam that God appeared, after the Garden of Eden, that God appeared to Adam. We don't have any record that God appeared to anybody up to this time. But we have a whole series of these in the life of Abraham. I personally believe they were appearances of Jesus Christ himself. An incarnate, pre-incarnation appearance of Christ. And so Abraham's call begins in Ur with God appearing to Abraham in his glory. That's what it says. The God of glory appeared unto our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia. And so that begins a whole series of theophanies that we're going to see as we go through the life of Abraham. Now, I'm not sure what all happened here before this particular call. It seems that Terah also heard something from God, and the whole family moved up to Haran, and for some reason they all became entangled there, and God has to renew this call to Abraham. That's the way it looks to me. We talked the last time about how Terah lost his vision, and It says he died. Now, some people have done some work with the figures here, and they say he couldn't possibly at this point have died physically. They say it means, and Stephen refers to that in Acts 7, that Abraham left Haran after his father was dead. And some people looking at the figures here say that has to mean a spiritual death. That when he saw that there was no possibility that his father was going to pursue this vision with him, then he left. And so this man had lived, I don't know how many years, under the discipline of a delayed vision. And that's a very hard thing to live with. I mean, there are people who get a vision, and if it isn't executed immediately, and they're surrounded by all kinds of distractions, they soon lose the vision. And the thing I've got to say about Abraham is here he is, this vision is still there, and he's ready to act upon it. All right. Well, let's put my outline here on the board. I think I have room to leave that there for you to look at. We're talking about Abram, he's not Abraham yet, God's faith pioneer. First thing we want to see is Abram's abandonment. Abandonment. I knew that was going to happen. To faith. And that will be 12:1-9. Yeah, I still don't have it right. D-O-N. Okay. And then 2, we have Abram's failure. Of faith. That's 12:10-20. And we finally have Abram's restoration. Of faith. And that'll be chapter 13. Okay. Let's read this first 9 verses. Now, the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house. Now, it doesn't say he said it freshly to him. It said he had said it. In other words, it's just a renewal of what God had already said. Unto a land that I will show thee, and I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. So, Abram departed as the Lord had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. And Abram took Sarah his wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the souls that they had gotten in Haran. And they went forth to go to the land of Canaan, and into the land of Canaan they came. And Abram passed through the land unto the place of Sichem, unto the plain of Moreh, and the Canaanite was then in the land. And the Lord appeared unto Abram and said unto him, unto thy seed will I give this land. And there he builded an altar unto the Lord who appeared unto him. And he removed from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west and Hai on the east. And there he builded an altar unto the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. And Abram journeyed, still going toward the south. All right. Well, I am impressed by the gospel note of this passage. You know, I told you that the book of Genesis is closer to the gospels than it is to the law. The law says do this, 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 and this. The gospel says forsake all. Forsake all and come and follow. And that's what we have here. God wants a total disentanglement with his country, with his kindred, with his family who had become idolaters. He wanted Abraham to totally disentangle himself from them. And he wanted also for this man who had been a city dweller, who was used to civilization, was used to an organized society. He wanted this man to become totally disconnected and become a pilgrim and not become attached to anything. He wanted this man to journey in faith, without any entanglements. All right? Now, Abraham's part was one thing. To venture all for God and leave everything. Exchange the known for the unknown. That's what God asked him to do. But when God asks us to do that, He doesn't do that and just leave us hanging. Did you notice in verses 1, 2, and 3, the way the I will stack up here? God says, Abraham, I'm asking you to leave. I'm asking you to go. And I'm going to take you to another land. That's all you have to do is just go. But here's what I will do. I will show thee the land. I will make thee a great nation. I will bless thee. I will bless them that bless thee. I will. It's such an encouragement to me that when God asks us to do something, He asks us basically to do something very, do the simple part. And then He stacks up a whole bunch of I wills around us. He says, I'll do this and I'll do this. And Ronnie was touching on some of them this morning. God has promised so many things He's going to do for the little bit that He has us to do, which is to totally trust Him. Somebody has said God made Abram a sevenfold promise here. He promised to give him a great inheritance. He promised to give him this land. He promised him a great posterity. He had no son, but He promised that he would become a great nation. He had left his good name, Abram had a good name or a great name, let's say, where he had been before. And God promises to give him a great name. He promises to give him a great blessing. He had left his father. Fathers usually passed on their blessing to their children. He left all that. He left his name. He left his blessing. He left everything. And God says, I'll give you a name. I'll give you a nation. I'll give you my blessing. God promised him a great alliance. He said, you and I are going to work at this together. I'm going to be with you. He gave him a great defense. He says, if anybody blesses you, I'll bless them. And if anybody curses you, I will curse them. I'm reminded of Psalm 23 where God says, well, my rod and thy staff, they comfort me. God does take the responsibility to protect people who make themselves vulnerable like Abram did. And He says, you'll have a great influence. All the families of the earth will be blessed because of you. So for the commitment that Abram made to leave all, forsake all, adventure all for God and be a pioneer, God says, I'll give you a great inheritance. I'll give you great posterity. I'll give you a great name. I'll give you great blessing. I'll give you a great alliance with me. I'll give you a great defense and I'll give you a great influence. And then it says, so Abram departed. That blesses me. With those kinds of promises, why wouldn't you? So he departed as the Lord had spoken to him. And I like the way that says that, as the Lord had spoken to him. He heard all that that God said. And he says, this venture is certainly a very reasonable venture. And he ventures 400 miles southwest of Haran. And he took along with him quite a train of people. They say they tell me that comment there, that all the souls that they had gotten in Haran, there's the idea of proselytization. So he'd already won some converts and already had convinced some people to follow him as he followed God. And I don't know how many people there were. We find out later he had 318 people in his house. This man's influence, this man's blessing, this man's persuasion had already begun. And they journey south to Shechem. Shechem is right here in about the middle of the land. Does anybody remember anything about Shechem? This is a very important part of the country. This is where Israel met at the beginning of their history. And Mount Gerizim was on a hell of a step to turn the right way. Mount Gerizim was on the... I still don't have it. Yeah, Mount Gerizim was on the left and Mount Ebal was on the right. And half of the people stood on Mount Gerizim and recited all the blessings in Deuteronomy 28. And half of the people stood on Mount Ebal and recited all the curses in Deuteronomy 28. And the people had to choose. That's where they ended up. Here Joshua would give his last charge. Here the kingdom would be divided eventually. And that's where Abraham came to. He came to Shechem. All right? It says that he came to the plain of Moreh. Now, Moreh means teacher. It seems as though this was a place, an oracle, where the heathens had some wise person like they had in Greece that people came to from all over the Canaanite nation to seek an answer from the heathen gods. And so here he goes to the middle of the land. Here he goes to the middle of the idolatry. Here he goes to the middle of this whole system. And there he builds an altar. And I guess when I read that, I was thinking of when our men went to the moon. And the one thing they were really concerned about is that they would put a U.S. flag there to let everybody know, this belongs to the United States. And Abram went to Shechem, and there he built an altar. It doesn't say what he did there with that altar. Later on, it talks about what he did when he built an altar. But here it doesn't say. He built an altar. It was a token that he and God were taking possession of this land. Now, I don't know what Abraham was thinking when he went to Israel, to Canaan. But I said he was used to civilization. He was used to a settled life. I think Abram sort of thought that when he got there, God would give him a place to settle. But lo and behold, this man's trial of faith begins right here. It says the Canaanite was in the land. The land was full of people. There really wasn't any place for him to settle. And he wasn't to find the rest he was looking for. That was all a matter of faith. As there are parallels, of course, in our lives as well. I mean, we want rest so badly, and the Lord says, keep journeying. I'm going to give you rest, but keep journeying. All right? Well, it says he built an altar there. All right? Then he kept going. He went on down to Bethel, and that means the house of God. Of course, I think the place was named later. And there he pitched his tent. It's interesting. Abraham pitches his tent and he builds an altar. He doesn't build a house. He pitches his tent and he builds an altar to the Lord. And it says here that he called upon the name of the Lord. Here. All right? And then in 12:9, we find him still journeying. The promises are all delayed. All of the things that God gave to him or said to him when he abandoned all for God, none of them have really happened. What would you have done? Well, we know what most people do. But for his disappointment, he did have some consolation. He had God's presence. I said, God appeared to this man. He knew absolutely for certain that what God had told him was true, because God had told him in person. And he had worship, not to an unknown God, but to a God who was very real to him. And so that's all Abraham had. That's all he had. And there are times in life that that's all we have. I think of 2 Peter there where it says, we follow until the day spring arise in our hearts. And we have the confirmation within ourselves that we are serving a real God who has had real dealings with us and has made himself manifest to us. And when we get into these kinds of situations, we just keep on following. And we have this great consolation of God's presence to encourage us, even though what we maybe had hoped does not come to pass. You know, there are some people that are looking constantly for tangible proof of their faith at every step. Well, that's not a walk of faith. Abraham had to learn that he had to be satisfied that God had made himself real to him, and in many of the other things in life, it wasn't all what he maybe had expected it to be. Well, that's the abandonment to faith. He abandoned all to God. Wherever he went, he built altars. He pitched his tent, picked up his tent, went, built another altar. That was Abraham's life. It was all God and all trust and all faith. Everything was left behind. God promised him great things, but they were all in the future. Well, Abraham was a normal human being. If you notice in the next section, we have Abraham's failure of faith. And that's the reason this lesson was such an encouragement to me to see here how all this worked out. It says there was a famine in the land. I mean, can't you hear the devil saying to Abraham, now God told you to leave everything, and he'd lead you to a land, and they make great promises about this land, and it's full of people, and furthermore, there's a famine. You don't even have enough food to eat. Are you sure you can really trust this God? Well, God had said, go to Canaan, and I will bless you. And Abraham should have held on to that, but Abraham was a human being. And here's this great giant of faith that has the same problem that I have, and that I'm sure you have. That's all nice and good, but what happens when you really are in the crunch? And here we are, we have a famine. Now, I don't think it was necessarily wrong for them to go down to Egypt. In fact, it doesn't say that God told him anything here. You just thought God would have said, well, now, Abraham, there's a famine in the land. God led Jacob and his family down to Egypt through clear leading, of course, with the selling of Joseph and slavery and all of that. And he gets on the throne and they need to go down there for food. And they finally, God tells Jacob, go on down. God leads them all to Egypt. And so that's why I say I'm not sure it was wrong for them to go to where there was food. But it was a blessing to me to realize that Abraham got in this situation like we do sometimes, and he had to sort of feel his way through circumstances without a clear, thus saith the Lord, this is what you should do about the famine. Now, I very completely believe that Abraham could have stayed right in Canaan and God would have taken care of him. And I don't really think this was God's perfect will, but another thing that blesses me is even though it wasn't his perfect will, God went with him to Egypt. And it's good he did. But this shows a real man just like you and me. We get into these kinds of circumstances. We don't maybe have a clear word and don't know exactly what to do. We do the best we can. But God is still there. He doesn't abandon us. He goes right with us. Even if we go into the kind of problems that Abraham went into. I think the thing he did wrong is what he did on the way to Egypt. There was no reason in the world why he couldn't go to Egypt. He couldn't trust God in Canaan. He should have been able to go to Egypt and trust God there, but he couldn't trust God there either. This was a total collapse of this man's ability to totally abandon everything and leave it to God. I think he sort of reasoned. His wife was fair, by the way, and the children of Ham in Egypt were sort of darker skinned. And, of course, when they saw someone with a lighter skin, that immediately looked beautiful to them. And I think Abraham, on his way down to Egypt, started passing some of these traders going to and fro and saw them making sidewise glances at his wife. And he thought, now what's going to happen when I get to Egypt? Those people are polytheistic. They're immoral. They are cruel. I mean, they're gonna want this woman, and they're gonna kill me, and they're gonna take her. Now, if I say she's my sister, and that was a half truth, even though it was a whole lie, they had the same dad, but they didn't have the same mom, so they were half sisters. And he said, if I tell them that she's my sister, I'm not sure what'll happen, but if I don't tell them, they're gonna kill me, and they're gonna have her anyway. So maybe this is the best of two bad decisions. I'll say she's my sister, and at least I'll be saved alive. I don't know what will become of her. When you think about this, this was an awful thing. This guy was bartering his wife's purity and her character and everything to save his own skin. I mean, this was a real failure. This was not a small thing. In fact, because he said she was his sister, she opened the way for Pharaoh to do the very thing he did. As the story turns out, it seems as though if he'd have said, she's my wife, Pharaoh would have respected that. And so in a way, he basically egged Pharaoh on to do what he did. Oh my. His self was more important than his wife's chastity. I mean, Abraham really, this is an encouragement to me. We shouldn't talk about failures. Maybe there's somebody sitting here that can't identify with this, but I can. I mean, here's this great man of God who failed about as miserably as you can fail, bartering his wife's purity to save his own skin. That's horrible. I hope there's nobody here that would do that to your wife. Maybe you're better than Abraham. Anyway, no, I don't think we're better than Abraham. I think we're all pretty much in the same boat. Well, there's one thing that Abraham didn't do that Hebrews tells us. It says if he had wanted to, he would have had opportunity to go back. And he didn't do that. He did not renege on his commitment to leave. Now, there are some people that get in these kinds of situations, and the failure that they perpetrate is to go back. Just abandon the whole thing. Don't trust God. Got to this land. There are people in it. There's a famine. I mean, my. I must have had too much peanut butter before I went to bed. This just isn't right. I'm going to go back to Ur. Back where everything is predictable. And where there's food to eat. And where there's some order, at least. He didn't do that. The Hebrews said he would have had opportunity to return, but he didn't do that. That's one thing I want to say about Abraham. I mean, we can make our mistakes, but we can still be people of faith journeying with God. Don't ever look back. Don't ever go back. You don't have to do that. No matter what kind of mistakes you make, you don't have to go back. All right? Well, at the first touch of hunger, we have fear. We have a lost vision. This just was a bad situation all around. Well, it says, let's read this, the rest of the chapter. Chapter 12, verse 10. And there was a famine in the land, and Abraham went down into Egypt to sojourn there. See, he wasn't planning to stay. He still was on God's program for Canaan. For the famine was grievous in the land. And it came to pass when he was come near to enter into Egypt, that he said unto Sarai his wife, Behold, now I know that thou art a fair woman to look upon. Therefore it shall come to pass, when the Egyptians shall see thee, they will say, This is his wife, and they will kill me, and they will save thee alive. Say, I pray thee, that thou art my sister, that it may be well with me, for thy sake, and my soul shall live because of thee. And it came to pass that when Abram was come into Egypt, the Egyptians beheld the woman, that she was very fair. The princes also of Pharaoh saw her, and commended her before Pharaoh. And the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. And he entreated Abram well for her sake, and he had sheep and oxen, he asses, and men servants and maid servants, and she asses and camels. I tried to imagine how Abraham felt when they came bringing all this stuff. These were gifts for his wife, for his sister, sorry. Do you think he was blessed? Those gifts must have... Oh! Every time they brought a drove of cattle and another hunk of silver and another talent of gold, his heart must have felt, oh, this is awful. I want my wife. What have I done? I've sold her. Look what she's worth. That must have been an awful thing. I didn't finish reading. And the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, What is this that thou hast done unto me? Why didst thou not tell me that she was thy wife? Why saidest thou she is my sister? So I might have taken her to me to wife. Now therefore, behold thy wife. We know who she is now. Take her and go thy way. And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away, and his wife, and all that they had. Now the word commended here, let's talk about Sarai for just a little bit. The word commended here is the first usage of this word in the Bible. Halal. Which means to praise. And I think, you know what I think was happening here? I don't think it was just her fair skin. I think this woman was radiating all the glory and beauty of womanhood blessed by God. I don't think they were just attracted to this woman because of that. They praised her. They saw something in her that was lofty beyond anything human. And that blesses me. What could have happened in Egypt if they told Pharaoh the truth? Here's this man, here's his wife, and they call forth from us praise. Can you imagine the disappointment when they found out what really these people could be like? Well, it was a sad end to the glory of God radiated from Sarah. Sad end. What was the wealth worth to Abraham with Sarah in Pharaoh's house? And I think these two must have spent many a sleepless night wondering what in the world was going to happen. They were totally helpless. They had put themselves into a corner. And that's why I said I'm glad we can be certain when we do this kind of stuff. As long as we don't go back, God is still there. Because now they needed God. If they ever needed God, they needed Him now. And He was there. And so He plagued Pharaoh's house. And Pharaoh, and I don't know what those plagues were. It's interesting. They're sort of a precursor to what God did later in Egypt. But anyway, Pharaoh realized that Abraham and Sarah were under the protection of God. I don't know what those plagues were. I don't know if people died. I don't know what happened. I sort of think that. When I was going through this, I was just thinking, what? And I've already said this. The tremendous opportunity these two had to show the glory of God in their faces and the honesty and sincerity and genuineness and transparency of their lives and God flowing through all of that to these Egyptian people might have changed the whole history of Egypt. I mean, I like to dream what could have happened. But Pharaoh did not respect them. He was not attracted to their God. He rebuked them and he had no choice but to send them away. And I can imagine it was two very, very quiet people the whole way back to Canaan. I think these people walked with their heads down, filled with shame. There's nothing more embarrassing than for a religious man to be rebuked by an irreligious man who is more righteous than the religious man. That's about the most shameful thing you can have happen. I don't know if you've ever had it happen to you, but I've had an ungodly man already have to call me up short. And that's one of the most embarrassing things that can happen. Here, I'm a Christian. He's not a Christian. And he has to tell me what's right. Here the Egyptians were first impressed. But they had brought suffering. Instead of blessing, they'd brought suffering on the house of Pharaoh. And the Egyptians, I think, in the end, despised them. And something happened also with his servants. We find in the next chapter, they are quarreling. Before Abram goes to Egypt, you have the picture of a family, of a household that respects this patriarch, and they work together. Lot respects him. The two sets of servants respect each other, and everything is at peace in God's house. But that's not the picture when they came back from Egypt. The very first thing that happens in this next chapter is there's quarreling. And something happened to Lot down there in Egypt. I guarantee you that he was a different man when he came back. He was enamored with the world. And his lusts were intensified. And he got his eye on riches and on cattle. And he didn't have much respect now for Abraham because of what had happened. I'm just guessing how this all was. And so here you have this very sad scene in the next chapter. People say Abraham was rich. Did you ever know where he got those riches? He got them there in Egypt when he bartered his wife's character. That's where they came from. And he reaped, even though God forgave him. We're going to talk about his restoration. He was to reap. Where did Hagar come from? She came from Egypt. Where did the riches come from? They came from Egypt. Where did the flocks come from? They came from Egypt. The quarreling and all of that was the result of Abram's failure in Egypt. If it wouldn't have been for the wife being given to Pharaoh, he'd have never gotten all that stuff. He'd have gone down there and lived. God would have provided for his needs, and he wouldn't have left Egypt a rich man. In fact, it says he was rich. That word literally in the Hebrew means heavy. He came back with riches. Heavy. Burdened. Now you know what I think of the riches of Abraham, if anybody ever talks to you about how rich Abraham was. I don't look at that as any great blessing. It was a curse the whole way. It was the curse of Egypt on Abraham. Now we have the restoration of his faith in chapter 13. Let's take time to read it. And Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him into the south. And Abraham was very rich, I said that word means heavy, in cattle and in silver and in gold. Don't you think they had fun carrying all that stuff back to begin with? But I think it weighed heavier on his soul than it did on his arms. And he went on his journeys from the south even to Bethel. unto the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Hai, unto the place of the altar which he had made there at first. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord. And Lot also, which went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents. And the land was not able to bear them, and that they might dwell together. For their substance was great, so that they could not dwell together. And there was strife between the herdmen of Abram's cattle, and the herdmen of Lot's cattle, and the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelt then in the land. And Abram said unto Lot, Let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my brethren and thy herdmen, for we be brethren. Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, I will go to the right. Or if thou wilt depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. And Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar. See, that's what Lot saw. Looks like the land of Egypt. That's what I want. Then Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves, the one from the other. Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent toward Sodom. But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. And the Lord said unto Abram, after that Lot was separated from him, Lift up now thine eyes, and look from the place where thou art northward, and southward, and eastward, and westward. For all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. And I will make thy seed as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall thy seed also be numbered. Arise, walk through the land in the length of it, and in the breadth of it, and I will give it unto thee, for I will give it unto thee. Then Abram removed his tent, and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and built there an altar unto the Lord. Now the thing that's to be said for Abram's credit, he went straight to Bethel, where he had called upon the name of the Lord. Didn't go to Shechem to renew this great vision where his flag was planted. That's not where he went. He wasn't too much interested in the vision. He was interested in getting right with God. And so he goes straight to Bethel. And it seems as once he did that, he immediately recovered his lost nobility, his lost character, his lost grandeur that he had before he left. And I'm thinking also Psalm 23, He restoreth my soul. I've been doing some sermons on Psalm 23, places where I've been, and that just blesses me, that the Lord restores our soul. How many times have we failed like Abraham's failed? And here's this wonderful characteristic of God, redemption and restoration. And he did it. And Abraham was whole again. And then immediately he was tested. The land again was not sufficient to meet their needs. It was the same test all over again. Before it was famine. I don't think it was famine at this point. But where they were, the grass was just too skimpy. It just wasn't enough there. The land was not sufficient. And Abraham could have been tempted, like Lot was, to look down there and say, well, we'll go there. But he didn't do that. Abraham knew that riches and large herds of flocks were not a blessing. In Egypt, they had been a curse. And he wasn't going to go there. But Lot's weaker nature had been permanently warped by Egypt. And now riches does what wanderings and want had never done. Deprivation and problems and whatever they had never separated Lot and Abraham. But now riches and an exposure to Egypt brings problems between these people. But Abraham was equal to this one. He rose as high on this one as he went low on the other one. Because he had his perspective back again and he had his relationship with God intact. And the wisdom that we see here sprang from the faith that was restored in Abraham. Abraham was probably thinking something like this. I've already renounced everything. It won't hurt to refresh my commitment. Take it. I already know that the unseen is more real than the seen. You can have what your eyes see. And he didn't get angry. He'd had every right to. And anger is a terrible thing. But Abraham did not, you don't have any hint here. What you have here is relinquishment, self-surrender, forgiveness, beautiful spirit. The fact of the matter is, the spirit will not bear its fruits in an angry heart. It won't happen. A peaceful mind and a heart, peaceful mind and heart are prerequisites for God's grace. I think of those verses that says, the wrath of man does not work the righteousness of God. The fruit of peace is sown in peace of them that make peace. And Abraham cultivated here because of his restored relationship with God. He demonstrates a tremendous, magnanimous spirit of forgiveness and unselfishness and self-surrender, and you can have it. I don't need any of it. You know, Abraham knew that there was a lot of land. There was plenty of land for all of them. You know, as I've gotten older, I've sort of taken that view. As churches, things get a little tight sometimes, and differences of opinion, and there may be there are difficulties sometimes that can't be resolved. I used to know that old Roman Miller, the bishop at Hartville, had this idea, and maybe that's where the germ of it started in my mind. Listen, we have the whole land. It's all pretty much unchurched in the true sense of the word. Why can't we all be magnanimous? And even if the other party isn't acting right, say, go. There's the land. You may have it all. I told you God would like it into small little units anyway. He doesn't want these big units that try to keep a whole bunch of stuff together and keep it under control. Well, I just give that for what it's worth. Anyway, Abraham magnanimously says, go take it. I don't want it. It won't be a blessing. It will be a curse. I'm satisfied with my tent. I'm satisfied with my promises. I'm satisfied with my God. I'm a lover of peace. I don't like strife. Family means a lot to me. I'd sooner have good relationships with you, Lot, living down there than to have you here and not have family. He reverenced the bond of brotherhood. He said, don't you understand, Lot? We are brethren. We cannot do this. We cannot fight. I have too much reverence for the bond and the promise of brotherhood to fight with you, Lot. I read this and I was very convicted. Why can't we have this attitude? Why can't we reverence family? Why can't we reverence brotherhood? Why can't we reverence all these things that he did? He was ready to surrender himself to the divine order, whatever it was. Lot could have his paradise. Abraham had his promises. But oh, Lot, can you imagine this guy? Who had been given the promise for the land? Abraham, not Lot. And he very presumptuously takes Abraham's offer and says, I'll take the best. No reverence for the fact that his uncle basically had the right to all of it. No acknowledgement to Abram's godly influence. This man now, this is presumption. Lot has always been the weaker one, apparently. And now he's really in bad shape. And now he's going to do the very thing he doesn't need to do. He's going to separate himself from his godly uncle. It doesn't seem to bother him. He's willing to risk spiritual damage. This is selfishness in the extreme. I'm going to go off by myself. I'm going to have what I want. Doesn't seem to be any recognition here of the kind of things that were important to Abraham. And even justice. This is an awful picture. But I want you to notice what God does. He compensates Abraham. He enlarges his promises. You notice what God says. He says, lift up your eyes, look toward from the place where thou art northward and southward and eastward and westward. And that included those plains down there that Lot had claimed. It included those too. And he said, Abraham, it's all yours. And to your seed, forever. Now God had not, that's a much larger promise than he'd made before. Now it becomes specific. He says, as far as you can see, north, south, east, and west, it's yours, and it's yours forever. For all the land that thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. And now he promised to make a nation out of Abraham, but now he enlarges that promise. He says, your descendants are going to exceed the sand of the seashore, or the dust of the earth, as the dust of the earth. If any man can number the dust of the earth, then shall thy seed also be numbered. And if this doesn't impress you, Abraham, then you start walking. Walk as far north as you want to walk. Walk south, walk east, walk every place where your foot touches. That's going to belong to you. And notice, he says over and over again, thy seed, thy seed, thy seed, thy seed. I think three times he says it here. So here we have Abraham, the restoration of faith. I want to go to Bethel. I want to go, call upon the name of the Lord. I want to be restored. I want the kind of nobility of character, the kind of strength of wisdom, and the kind of ability to respond even in the face of the most trying circumstances and the most awful, presumptuous greed and disrespect. I mean, this was really bad. But Abraham just rises above it all. He did as well here as he did poorly before, because he had his relationship with God intact. And then it says in verse 18, then Abram removed his tent and came and dwelt. Finally, he gets to rest. Up till now, he's sojourning. And you're going to find he's going to stay at Hebron for a while now. God finally, after all these trials and after restoring Abraham and bringing out of him the best in his character, he says, now, Abraham, I'm going to let you dwell. He dwelt in the plain of Mamre. Mamre was the name of a man. Again, it means a teacher. Apparently, he was a true wise man, because Abraham, we're going to find later on, becomes his ally, and they become good friends. And so God gives Abraham a good friend. He gives him a place to dwell. He gives him a promise of innumerable seed, and he gives him the whole land. I'm reminded of the verse that says, blessed are the meek. Let's all say it together. For they shall inherit the earth. And here's a good example. Does anybody have any comments you want to make?